Lecture 20. Etruscan Women.
Luxurious, frivolous, depraved. We're talking about Etruscan women. These descriptions, and many similar ones, come from Greek and Roman authors who were reflecting on how they perceived the status of women in Etruscan society. Etruscan women inspired strident condemnation. But what was it that angered or possibly frightened the foreign commentators? Greek and Roman accounts start with the Etruscan banquet and extrapolate from such ritual-filled ceremonies the circumstances from which to create their own notion of Etruscan society. And they're a hoot to read. Theopompus, a Greek historian of the 4th century BC, wrote that all Etruscan women were capable drinkers and very beautiful in appearance. That might sound like a compliment to many of us, but the way Theopompus words his praise makes obvious that he's being very uncomplimentary. The hyperbole is really intended as an unspoken comparison with Greek women, who were expected to refrain from drinking wine or dining with unrelated men. And they weren't seen in public in situations where their beauty would be obvious. Theopompus says further that Etruscan women take great care of their bodies with exercise and that they shave their bodies smooth, which might be accurate, but seems unlikely to refer to all Etruscan women. After all, someone has to do the chores, and they can't all be sitting around grooming all the time, leading a very sort of Kim Kardashian sort of lifestyle. Let's test this by examining each role that Etruscan women filled. We'll briefly outline what we know and draw comparisons to the examples of women from other ancient cultures. But even before we launch into the survey, I'll briefly mention bias. Our sources are all biased in favor of discussing elite women. The lives of lower-class Etruscan women probably weren't a lot different between those of the Romans and Greeks and most other people of antiquity. When people speak the idiom, "a woman's work is never done," they aren't being flip. And the poorer the woman, the more endless the work. For most women, raising children and taking care of the home was their job. One task alone, working wool to make all of the fabric used in the household, could consume all daylight hours, and sometimes hours long into the night. But as for elites, let's begin with priestesses. As far as we can tell, every society has had women religious figures whom we refer to collectively as priestesses. And the range of their activities and religions is huge. In general, however, the patterns we see in Etruscan society differ dramatically from those in Greek city-states. In Greek society, women held a large number of positions as priestesses, but they were removed from any political engagement or influence. The closest were the oracles of Apollo, such as the Pythia, the oracle of Apollo at Delphi. Pythia's pronouncements did frequently shape the Greek military and political world, but she was never actively involved herself. And some scholars think her prophecies were delivered by the priests who interpreted her. The presumption is that the priests could interpret whatever they wished. Etruscan priestesses and oracles were far different. Of these, the best known in terms of public engagement was the priestess of Mater Matuta. That's the Latin name of the nourishing mother goddess, the Etruscan primary goddess Uni. The Etruscan king of Rome, Servius Tullius, built her temple in Rome, and she played a key role in the transition between kings. After a king dies, the Senate and people would vote to nominate a man as successor. That man would spend the night in the temple, communing with the goddess, and in the morning, the priestess would appear, probably at a window, and announce the goddess's support for him. Mata Matuta's temple was decorated with a terracotta sculpture group of Athena leading Hercules to his apotheosis, that is, becoming a god, clearly a mythological metaphor for the activity of declaring kingship. In this way, the priestess acted as an agent of political change, confirming the acceptance of the new king. Other female religious figures were active agents of political change in ways that the Greeks would have found anathema. For example, the Etruscan prophetess Tanaquil, wife of Tarquinius Priscus, was the agent of succession for two kings. First, her husband, who, as they were traveling to Rome to immigrate, had his hat snatched by an eagle, which then returned it, symbolically crowning him. Tanaquil also selected his successor by interpreting an omen that affected another Etruscan, Servius Tullius, whose head was circled by a ring of flames yet remained unburned. Similar stories were told about the Sibyl at Cumae, the female oracle of Apollo in southern Italy. First, that she is the one who directed Aeneas on his journey to the underworld, which was a necessary precondition to his visit to the location where Rome would be founded. Second, that she appeared one night in disguise to the Etruscan king Tarquinius and offered to sell him 9 books of prophecy. When he rejected these, she went away, but returned the next night with 6 books, having destroyed 3. Again, he refused. And again, she returned the next day with 3 fewer books. Now, he bought the 3 remaining ones. Passed down from Tarquinius, these are the books of prophecy that Rome turned to in moments of crisis, obtaining from them the means of, for example, removing Hannibal from Italy. Now, these are myths, but myths are stories with cultural relevance, and these establish the model for women in religious positions to act as agents of political change. I think it's particularly significant as the stories involve Etruscan kings, priestesses, and prophets. These might be seen as just stories, except we know that the Vestal Virgins, the priestesses of the goddess Vesta, had political input, as they operated as the pardon authority in Rome and could pardon those convicted of capital crimes. Well, what about other actual priestesses? Well, images of priestesses are found as votives at shrines across the Etruscan world. The Etruscan word for priestess, hatrenku, is found as well, most remarkably, in what's called the Tomb of the Inscriptions, a 4th century BC tomb found at the Etruscan city of Vulci. In the 6 burial chambers there, at least 5 sarcophagi, or stone coffins, are found there, labeled for women, marked as hatrenku. The really remarkable thing is that their names tell us they come from 3 different families. These women's primary identity at burial was as priestesses, and they seem to have been buried collegially, that is, with other priestesses, rather than with their husbands and children or their birth families. This is a pattern unseen in Greek culture for women, and used for men only when they'd performed some great service for the state, such as the Athenians who fell at the Battle of Marathon. 2 major cultural constructs of Greek society were that women were defined first by family and that matters of state were the province of men. The Etruscans had other ideas, and that must have been one source of the Greek outrage at the role of women. Support for the notion that Etruscans equated the office of hatrenku with male public service comes from another 4th century BC sarcophagus from Vulci, that of Ramtha Visnai and Arnth Tetnias, that's a wife and a husband. The sarcophagus lid is a joint portrait of the two of them, lying in bed, arms around each other. Three sides of the body of the sarcophagus are carved in relief, with images that convey exact social and public equality between the married couple. The front, or the long side of the sarcophagus, is a perfectly symmetrical scene of the couple standing in the center, facing each other. Her left arm is around his shoulders, and his right hand grasps her right wrist. It's an image of marriage, possibly of the wedding itself. Each of them has four attendants, all carrying symbols of status and office. For him, the magistrate's chair, the fasces, a military horn, and the double flute used in religious processions. Behind her, attendants carry the box of ritual implements used by a priestess, a situa and anakoi, which are vessels for sacrifices, a fan, and a lyre. On the two short ends are departure scenes, presumably for the afterlife, with the man, Arnth, stepping into a chariot on one end, while his wife, Ramtha, rides in a cart on the other. She sits with another woman of high status. I think it's another Hatrenku, with whom she was buried, and that the two are departing together for the afterlife. This brings us to the topic of women and their roles as wives. Theopompus of Chios begins his passage on the outrageous behavior of the Etruscans with the statement that sharing wives is an established Etruscan custom. But we know the Etruscan word for wife, pua, and the Etruscans practiced monogamy, like virtually everyone else in the ancient Mediterranean. Now, Theopompus might be referring instead to the indecency of Etruscan women appearing in public with men other than their husbands. That does seem to be true. At least they operated with far more independence, even appearing socially without their husbands in immodest outfits. In private, Etruscan wives also had far more freedom than their Greek or Roman contemporaries. With respect to Etruscan banquets as a shared social convention of men and women, I want to touch on one detail from the paintings from the 4th century BC Tumbogolini at Orvieto. These paintings show a woman overseeing the work in the kitchen as food is prepared for a banquet. She seems to be the hostess. She's clearly elite, as she's fully dressed in formal wear with a long gown and a cloak over it. She also wears jewelry. Her hair is up, held in place by a headband, and she has on large earrings and a necklace. The majority of the others in the kitchen are stripped to the waist as they work. This visual evidence, along with the finds of elaborate banqueting sets, drinking cups, and wine-serving vessels from women's tombs, provides more support for arguments of marital equality. In addition, Etruscan women had their own names, rather than just the feminine version of their father's name, and passed along names and property as well. To the ancient Greeks, that would sound as bad as wife-sharing. Theopompus complains further. The Etruscans raise all the children that are born without knowing who their fathers are. That does sound pretty scandalous, but what's it really mean? Well, there's no independent evidence for indiscriminate sexual behavior outside of marriage by either sex. So what might be the basis for his outrage? I think there are a number of factors here. First and foremost, in the Greek and Roman cultures, the father looked on a child at birth and decided, based on a number of factors, including whether he thought it was his, whether to raise the child or have it exposed, that is, removed from the household and left to die of exposure or to be claimed by someone else. Either way, it was no longer part of the family. That moment of decision by the father is his explicit acceptance of paternity. The Etruscans had no such custom, And in that way, they were closer to the Jews and ancient Egyptians than to the Romans or Greeks. No one set about trying to judge the identity of the father in order to decide whether to expose the child or not. All children were raised in the household of the birth mother. Well, while we're on the subject of sexual relations, Theopompus writes of intercourse, and it helps to read this with an outraged tone. It is no disgrace for them to do anything in the open, or to be seen having it done to them, for they consider it a native custom. I trust the meaning of his use of it and do is clear here. It seems on the face to be an absurd concept, and one that would seriously hamper the Etruscans from getting any work done. But remarkably, we have evidence for the basis of that statement, although the circumstances are more limited than he lets on. One of the wall paintings in the Tomb of the Bulls shows two couples out in a field having intercourse. The Tomb of the Floggings, also at Tarquinia, has another wall painting of two groups, each consisting of three people. In one group, a woman holds on to a man for support while having intercourse with another man. In the other, the woman bends over while holding on to one man, and another man behind her flogs her with a short whip. Each of these activities clearly takes place outdoors, bolstering Theopompus' statement that it's no disgrace for them to do anything in the open. These acts, however, represent a very specific form of religious ritual that is not unique to the Etruscans. These people are participating in rites of fertility using sympathetic magic. The idea that a specific sort of act carried out on one object or person will affect a magically related object or person. This is the notion behind voodoo dolls. The couple conducting intercourse in the fields are doing so to promote the fertility of the fields and to ensure the earth's productivity during the upcoming growing season. The woman being flogged is also participating in a fertility ritual based on the belief that it will ensure her fertility. The Romans retained this practice during their very odd, they didn't understand it fully either, Lupercalia festival, a spring fertility rite that involved whipping women who wished to be pregnant with a rawhide whip. In Cornwall, in southwestern England, apple growers used to go into the orchards on New Year's Day and whip the trees to encourage a good crop for the coming year. So yes, in the open, and yes, a custom. But I don't think this rises to the blanket statement made by Theopompus. But we can see, I think, where it came from. Well, having touched on the subject of sex, it seems time to address its most obvious side effect. Let's start with childbirth. Maternal mortality in childbirth is a very real danger. Historically, giving birth is one of the most dangerous things women do. We don't have reliable statistics for the ancient world, but we do for the modern world. Let's take some recent ones as, I think, exemplary. In 1936, African-American women in the United States had a maternal mortality rate of about 1%. That is, 1 out of 100 births ended with the death of the mother. By comparison, the mortality rate for the U.S. Army in World War II was 2.5%. On the face of it, serving in the Army during the war was 2.5 times as dangerous as giving birth. Except one served in the Army only once. Childbirth could and usually did happen multiple times. For the average woman, the mortality risk was roughly the same as serving in the Army. There's a reason the playwright Euripides has Medea proclaim, "I would rather stand armed with a shield 3 times than give birth once." So to mitigate the dangers, or at least the fears, associated with childbirth, Etruscan women invoked a number of divine protectors. We see evidence of this on a number of Etruscan mirrors with scenes of divine birth. The deity of childbirth, Thalna, almost invariably attends the births to ensure their success. Often these events include someone standing by with a bottle and what looks like a dipstick. This was to anoint the newly born child with oil, a standard practice to begin ritual protection for the infant immediately following birth. Such scenes were probably viewed as metaphors for mortal childbirth, and the mirrors on which they were engraved were given to women on their wedding day or when expecting. Along with the imagery, we find amulets and prayers. Only one image of an Etruscan woman giving birth survives. She's squatting in a position familiar from many works of ancient art across cultures and from the Paleolithic to the late Roman period. Assuming the mother and the child both survived the initial dangers of childbirth, the woman's fears would not be over. Child mortality was also a serious problem. And despite what you might have read elsewhere, people in the ancient world loved and cared for their children and mourned their children's deaths just as we would. The fear of premature death manifested itself in a number of shrines across the Etruscan world, where prayers, sacrifices, and votives were made to protect children. The clearest sign of this insecurity, especially as relates to newborns, is seen in a large number of terracotta votive sculptures found in these sanctuaries. Many have the same form of an enthroned goddess holding swaddled infants in her arms. In most of these, the goddess holds the infant in both hands resting on her lap, but in some, she cradles an infant in the crook of each arm, and in a few, she holds two or more in each arm. I've seen votive sculptures from the Etruscan sanctuary outside Capua in southern Italy that depict five swaddled infants cradled in each arm. Take that, Mary Poppins. Now, it's difficult to compare motherhood in Etruria with the same institutions in Greece and Rome. At least in the realm of art, such comparisons amount to a short conversation, since Greek and Roman art rarely depict images of mothers. Now, that says a great deal also about the status of Greek and Roman women, and cultural notions of privacy pertaining to women and children's lives in those cultures. They're not on public view. Images of mothers and infants as a symbol of maternity are familiar to us due to the ubiquity of Virgin Mary and Christ child depictions. Yet these are very rare in Greek pagan art because of the taboos against female public nudity and the idea of breast milk as a magical substance and potent medicine. The only common images of nursing mothers in Greek myth are ones that emphasize their role as innocent victims of violence. Nursing mothers having their infants snatched away by invaders are a visual shorthand for the fall of a city. It's likely that Greek notions of masculinity as well as propriety were factors as well. The Greeks seem to have de-emphasized female contributions to childbirth and care to a ridiculous extent. They used the analogy of the child as a loaf of bread, made by the baker, man, and placed in the oven, woman. Who should get credit for the loaf? The baker, of course. In Roman art, the bared breast generally shows female contempt for male social rules, as in images of Amazons. For the Etruscans, in contrast, images of nursing mothers were common. And with them, I see the cultural difference that I've mentioned before. Women are viewed as, to be conservative, something approaching equals, especially in the home. That's not to say there weren't established gender roles in Etruscan society. Women of all ranks were responsible for wool working, a very time-consuming chore that involved sitting around for long hours, spinning wool and weaving the yarn into fabric. Women would often work on their own projects, but in groups. Some scholars, citing modern or more recent examples from other cultures, conclude that Etruscan women probably sang or recited poetry as they worked, and even that such communion might have kept time with the rhythm of weaving. No Etruscan literature of this sort survived, so we can't be certain. But there's a great deal of evidence of female literacy in Etruria, more so than there is for Athenian women in the classical period or for Roman women of the Republic. The inscriptions found on Etruscan women's belongings, including mirrors, woolworking equipment, and banquet services, were written for female audiences. The vast numbers of such inscriptions represent very good evidence, not just that women were literate, but perhaps that literacy was assumed. Well, let's leave the house for now and talk about women in public. If this were a lecture on early Greece or Rome, we'd be done at the end of this sentence. Not so for the Etruscans. The banquet was the premier Etruscan social occasion, but there were many roles at those. Women, for example, were found at Greek symposia, but not as guests, only as servants or entertainment or paid companions. That might explain the final quote from Theopompus that I want to share with you. They do not share their couches with their husbands, but with the other men who happen to be present, and they propose toasts to anyone they choose. They are expert drinkers and very attractive. The children live the way their parents live, often attending drinking parties and having sexual relations with all the women. In reading this, three reasons occur to me to explain Theopompus' outrage. All can be summarized as, they wouldn't do this in Greek city-states. Well, outrage number one, women are socializing with men other than their husbands. Outrage number two, by proposing toasts, women are usurping the man's role. And outrage number three, that children often attend drinking parties. But Theopompus has mistakenly equated Etruscan banquets, that is, formal dining events, with Greek symposia, which were exclusively adult male drinking parties. And as for the last part, I very much doubt that children were having sexual relations with all, or even any, of the women. That's a recurring attack on depraved cultures made by outsiders who've never visited. So what were women doing in public? Well, looking at the tomb paintings as a data point, an interesting pattern emerges. In all of the extant Etruscan tomb paintings, we find 201 representations of women, I counted. Of these, 167 could be considered to depict women in public or social contexts. I'm excluding the lovemaking illustrations I mentioned or travels to the underworld. And of these, 79 depict dancing. The vast majority are in landscapes adjacent to banquet scenes. Others might be taking part in funeral ceremonies, largely games. We don't know if these were performances or participatory. 58 of the women are shown dining at banquets. 13 are serving at various functions, largely banquets, and 10 are spectators at public events. These latter are notable because they're consistently placed in the stands intermixed with the men. There's no attempt to segregate them as in Greek or even many Roman audiences. Four other women are shown playing instruments, either the lyre or flute, and three perform as acrobats. Now, I'm not suggesting that these numbers of women in various poses are proportionate to reality, but that they do represent a range of female public roles at all ranks in society that were unique to the Etruscans. And there's one other piece of evidence for the public roles of women. At the northern Etruscan city of Marzabotto, excavators have discovered a stone slab carved with a relief scene of a woman standing on an altar, one hand on her hip and the other raising a cup to her lips to drink. Her stance indicates that she is the object of a heroic cult. It again is indicative of the comparatively exalted status of Etruscan women. Etruscan women were seemingly equal partners in marriage. They fulfilled public, civic functions, and they were socially engaged. Each of these qualities set them apart from women in other ancient Mediterranean societies. Add to this the evidence of women's naming practices, women's literacy, and their inheritance rights. And it seems that the Roman and Greek authors who were scandalized about Etruscan culture might, indeed, have had good reason from their own unique vantage point. Many of the foundational concepts of their own cultures were overturned in the Etruscan one. Remarkably, many of the concepts of the place of women in modern Western culture were anticipated by the Etruscans.